The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by HubSpot. Imagine growing a business with high-quality leads, fast-closing deals, and wildly happy customers. It's not a miracle. It's HubSpot. Visit HubSpot.com to get started today.
LinkedIn News.
Hi, I'm Dan Roth, LinkedIn's editor-in-chief. Welcome to This Is Working, the podcast, where we offer the leaders of today an opportunity to share their knowledge with the leaders of tomorrow. Each episode of our podcast draws from a live conversation I had on LinkedIn. You'll hear that leader's top takeaways alongside analysis and a deeper dive from me and my colleague, Nina Melendez. Hello, Nina.
Hey, Dan. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Nina. Today is the end of my work week because I'm taking off tomorrow and going to Kentucky for the Kentucky Derby.
That is fun.
Yeah. Growing up, I used to go to the Derby occasionally. And mm-hmm. You can either sit in the stands at the Kentucky Derby mm-hmm. or the infield. And the infield is just, you never even see a horse in the infield. It is just a massive party. It's a lot of fun. I'm too old for that anymore, so I'm going to the stands this year, but I'm really excited.
What is your drink of choice when watching the Kentucky Derby?
I mean, you got to have a mint julep. I'm a fan of bourbon anyways.
Actually, what's inside a mint julep?
Mint, bourbon, sugar.
And more bourbon?
And then more bourbon.
I love it. That's great.
I think that's right.
Yeah.
What's your drink of choice?
It depends on the occasion. So like maybe just casually I'll do a gin and tonic. I like whiskey. I like to just sip on some whiskey. Mm-hmm. But for example, at the time of this recording, we're going to have Cinco de Mayo coming up. And at that point, I'll definitely have a margarita.
Do you have a recipe?
No. Did you know I'm part Mexican?
I didn't know that.
Yeah. My mom's mother is Mexican.
Got it.
And Ibarra is a very Mexican name.
Huh.
Yeah. So I was actually super excited when you spoke to Oscar Munoz.
Yes.
Recently, because he's of Mexican heritage.
Yeah, that's right. He immigrated to the U.S. when he was 8.
And actually, at the time that he joined United, he was the only Latino CEO of a major airline and only one of two Latino CEOs in the Fortune 100.
He had a storied career in corporate America. He held senior positions at AT&T, Coca-Cola, and CSX. And when he stepped into his role at United Airlines, it was not a great time for the company. There was low employee morale, record-setting customer complaints. They were the top most complained about airline for the Department of Transportation. They had financial troubles. They had union problems. And then he became CEO, suffered a cardiac arrest almost immediately after becoming CEO, and needed a heart transplant. So in his soon-to-be-released book, Turnaround Time, which I really enjoyed, Munoz recounts how we turn the struggling airline around using an employee-first approach.
I always enjoy hearing from CEOs, not just about the lessons they learned to get to the CEO chair, but the lessons they had to learn while they were there. One thing that Oscar said was that he got so much better at his job when he could understand who he was as a person and embrace who he was as a person. Let's take a listen to what he said.
Initially in my life, especially in my work life, being a Mexican-American in finance, it was like, well, what is this person? You know, you didn't feel like you belonged. So I over-indexed on the serious nature and I over-controlling. This all is going to reflect on me and my heritage. And it took a couple, you know, seminal moments in my personal life, my mom passing and all that, that just got me to slow my ass down. And I call it swing easy as an advice aspect of it. If you play golf or tennis, or you watch the pros, and it's just so smooth and easy, right? And then we get out there and hack it around and, you know, don't get near it. And so from a career perspective, how you approach that work life, that concept of swing and easy means be yourself. Know who you are. Be that self. Involve people around you for the things that you're not good at. And you would be amazed. My career trajectory, as nice as it was before I made this swing easy methodology change, the trajectory was exponential after that. So the swing easy intervention that we'll talk about was when I made a jump from I was a big hotshot, young hotshot at Pepsi, and I got a role at Coke. And it was a two-level jump in my career. I'm 26, 27 years old. And so I'm feeling pretty good about myself. And I go to this new company who I don't know any of, but I'm now the boss in a lot of ways. And of course, Coke and Pepsi culture is about as different as the city of New York here and the city of Atlanta. So I walk into the Coke environment people are generally older, a little bit slower paced. And for someone like me at my age, coming from this hard charging world of Pepsi, I'm like, I call it all asses and elbows. It's like, ah, it's like these people, oh my God, what are we gonna? And in my sort of transition, there was a, you know, my boss at the time, you know, sits me down, gives you kind of a midterm performance review sort of thing. And we talk about all the things I'm doing and it's all great stuff and I'm feeling good. And he closes the book. I remember the visual of him closing the sort of the HR concept. And he pushes it aside and he said, if you have a few minutes, you know, maybe we and I can talk something about more about on a personal side. And I'm like, oh, it's like he's gonna, maybe think he wants me to date his daughter or some arrogant thought of that nature. And what he said sticks with me to this day. He said, you know, you're really good. You've exceeded our expectations, but you're not yet as good as you think you are. And I remember thinking, it's like, wait, that didn't sound like a compliment. But what it meant, obviously, is like, slow your roll in today's parlance. You know, let people in. And I adopted that and began to see the people that I thought were older, and maybe a woman that I thought looked like my grandmother, you know, was a Harvard MBA, you know, 20 some years ago, but right. Nevertheless, I didn't have a Harvard MBA. And so I began to, you know, basically not judge a book by its cover.
As he was saying that, I was almost like sat back in my chair. This idea of someone telling you you're not as good as you think you are, I just kind of imagine what that must have felt like with Oscar feeling like he's done everything. He is like, he's perfectly poised. He knows his numbers cold. And now he's going to be told how great he is. And in fact, he's told like, you're not there yet. This was, I think, a really powerful point, this whole idea that he has around swing easy. I think it's really hard to put that into practice or to listen to that and figure out how you're going to bring that into your own life. Mm-hmm. So I think it's one thing for Oscar to look back and be like, oh, I had to learn how to do that. But I feel like maybe you kind of have to go through that pretty intense period first before you've bought the freedom to dial it back a little bit.
Yeah. I think what I have learned and noticed is that there's this general discomfort with not being good at something. And I think that's what happened with Oscar, you know, because he did hit all the metrics. His boss or his manager said, hey, you exceeded expectations. You did all this stuff. Just take a step back and let the people in the room who are smarter and who are older and have more experience teach you. And it's okay to not be good in the beginning.
Yeah, this is the entire growth mindset mentality is you're never done learning and you have to be okay being an amateur at something. If you are embracing the idea of growth mindset, you're always going to be an amateur. You constantly return to being an amateur, which means you have to listen to other people. You have to watch other people. You have to take cues from other people and then you get good.
So I used to live in Japan and I decided that I was going to take karate and I joined this dojo where literally everyone was a black belt. And here I came as like a foreigner who didn't speak Japanese. And it was so difficult, Dan, to go in there time after time and just suck at it. Because when you suck at karate, you get hit. And the thing is, like, they didn't stop the lessons to teach Nina. They, like, I had to keep up. And I was spinning in circles, literally turning left when everyone was turning right. I was getting hit on the left and holding up my right hand to block. Like it was. And then one day we were doing a kata. And one day it just came and I was doing everything everyone else was doing. And it was like the most relieving feeling of like, oh, I'm getting it. I didn't even know I was getting it. I was confused for months and now I'm getting it. And I think about that often when I'm bad at something, like just keep going and eventually you'll get good.
Yeah, it's a very hard lesson to learn. I was a linguistics minor in college. And one of the things that really stuck with me was this understanding in linguistics that it is very hard to pick up a second language after you're 13. And for a while, linguists thought there was something that happens in puberty that stops your brain from being able to start recognizing other languages. One of the realizations they had was actually when adults drink, they are better at foreign languages. And in fact, the problem is not that your brain shuts off at 13. It's that you start getting embarrassed about how you sound at 13.
Yeah.
So you don't want to learn another language because you sound like an idiot. And you're not good at it. And you're like, I'll never be good at this. So you stop learning it.
Yeah.
When you drink, those inhibitions go down. And so you start talking again in this other language. So I think it goes right back to that. You have to be okay being an amateur. You have to put yourself in a place where you're like, I'm willing to learn. I'm willing, in your case, to get beaten up.
Yeah. Get beaten up, feel embarrassed, look bad.
Yeah.
All of the stuff that's just difficult to go through, but then on the other side of it, it's awesome.
Exactly.
Dan, have you ever had to pull someone aside the way Oscar's boss at Coke did? Or have you ever been pulled aside in that way?
Before I came to LinkedIn, I was the editor of Fortune.com. I had a long career in magazine journalism, Fortune, Forbes, Portfolio Magazine. And I was an expert, and I was at the top of my field in many ways. And when I came to LinkedIn, I was no longer, that expertise was no longer that useful. And what I realized, not by someone pulling me aside, but by watching the conversation stop and then people then going back to what they were talking about, it was like, oh, I'm not as good as I thought I was.
Because this is a tech company.
Exactly.
So what made you be okay with going at the top of your game in one field to go being somewhat at the bottom of your game in another field?
Well, for me, it was a real understanding that the industry that I was in was going through massive changes. And if I wanted to have the career that I wanted to have and the career longevity that I wanted to have, it was going to require investing in totally new skills and expanding my network to people who I never would have met otherwise, technologists, product managers, people in tech. And so I figured I'm going to go. This will be a great investment. I'll go and I'll spend 2 years getting really smart at a tech company. And then I'll go back to traditional media. And that was 12 years ago. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, more on my conversation with Oscar Munoz.
The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. In the last 100 years, we've seen financial markets swing, new currencies come and go, decades of savings lost in days, all showing that a retirement plan without a guarantee, quite simply, isn't enough. So more than a retirement plan, TIAA makes you a retirement promise, a promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life, a promise that pays off. Learn more at TIAA.org/promisespayoff.
And we're back. Nina, we were just talking about that idea of coming in as an amateur. You know, Oscar was on the board of United, but he had never run an airline before. And he came in to United as CEO at a really troubling time for the airline. So he had to both prove himself, figure out the solution, and then convince everyone else it was the solution also. And what Oscar decided to focus on was this idea of being employee first. Of all the things he could have solved, he said, we're going to focus on employees.
I had lots of information, lots of feedback from everyone, but my sixth sense, my upbringing, my learning from Swing Easy back in the day was, you know what, before I jump into some, you know, strategic sort of conversation and speeches and presentations, I'm going to first listen to who I know is not happy, is their frontline employees. And I knew that because the concept of listening and engaging with humans, when you meet someone, you can tell if they're genuine, happy and excited, or I could tell in my visits with employees, as happy and wonderful and elated they seem to be, there was this something sort of brewing in the back that held on to me just a little longer that almost said, not to be dramatic, but help me, help us. So I knew something was up in that regard. So I went on a listening tour. You get lots of information, additional information from people. But it took a flight attendant who I approached, and she was reluctant to talk. And then she finally, in an emotional outburst of both tears and somewhat anger, said, you know what, Oscar, I'm just tired of always having to say, I'm sorry. And it just crystallized because I'd heard so many things. It's like, ah, there it is. We've put people in a position where they have to deliver a service, deliver products that they have nothing to do with. So I am sorry you don't like your coffee. I am sorry we're late, right? A flight attendant has nothing to do with either one. And there's no quicker way to disengage or disenfranchise or disillusion a human being that I have to do this job. I have no control over. I'm just a machine. So you know what? I'm going to deliver the service in that way. Here's your stuff. You know, if you want to complain, call someone else. So I knew all of that, but then I had to build consensus. I had to go get to my senior team because they had a lot of ideas. And of course my board, and then inevitably Wall Street, because a concept of regaining the trust of your employees, which was the final outcome and consensus in the team, doesn't fly well in a world where it's like, wait, what does that mean?
How does a manager build consensus? What does that look like?
I'm so glad you asked that, because I thought that was one of the more challenging parts of Oscar's decision to focus on employees. Oscar could have done two things. One is he could have just declared, we're going to start putting our employees first. We're going to measure their success, and their success is going to be our success. Instead, he went for a consensus approach with his direct reports. But it's not really consensus because he was driving them towards his decision. Mm-hmm. And I've seen this before among people I've worked for, and it's always masterful when they do it because they make you feel like it's
your
idea.
You're part of the decision
making. Yes, exactly. Yeah. And so people that can pull this off have my total admiration. A guy I used to work for had this whole five-step program to get consensus around his ideas. So I think a lot of people make this mistake. They think, well, building consensus is we all get into a room together and we come up with a conclusion together and we walk out with this new idea. But a lot of the times it's someone's idea and everyone is then buying into it.
Do you remember what those five steps were?
Yeah, the five steps were, number one, you have your idea and you put a rough, very, very rough plan together, most bare bones plan together around it. And you name your idea. You have to have some name for it. Then you start meeting with all of the big decision makers who need to get on board, all those people who have to come around and agree that this is the way to go. But again, you're not telling them what to do. So the next step is to go to all those decision makers and you sit down with them and you say, look, here's a problem. Do you agree that this is a problem we need to solve? And then everyone says, oh, yeah, I think that's the problem. And you go, all right, here's an idea I've been kind of thinking about. It's very rough. And he said, you have to have a whiteboard. And you start sketching out on the whiteboard. And you want to make sure you hand the pen to the other person. Have them sketch on the whiteboard also. And once they start doing that, they're kind of bought in then. It's their ideas on the whiteboard as well. And you start sketching out this thing together. It's now more fleshed out. You meet with them again. You say, remember what we talked about? Do you have any feedback here on what this is? And now they see themselves in this also. So that's step three. Step four is you say, can I meet with your teams about this? And can we present this idea together? Now all of their directs are hearing you two with a shared vision towards achieving something. And then he said the next step was you got to start telling the company about it. And he said for 6 months, he would go to any meeting he could because he said, you got to get everyone to buy into this. So I thought that was a really cool idea. Yeah. And so when he did it to me, I knew that was happening to me. And I still bought into it. And I still came around to his way of thinking. And he got we got consensus because I felt like I was part of the process.
And is that what Oscar did then?
It's exactly what Oscar did. His CFO, his head of IT, he talks in the book. He says, like, I knew what they were going to say. I knew the IT manager was going to say, we got to invest in systems. And the CFO was going to say, we've got to bring our costs down. And so everyone got their point. And then he brought up his. And then he started working his ideas into their ideas. And then eventually they realized why there was no way for them to achieve their objectives without first making employees feel like they loved working at United. And once you did that, everyone else's objectives could then be handled.
Dan, you're a manager and you manage now a team of over like 100 people.
200.
200. Crazy. What is the best way for an employee to go and complain or give a grievance to their boss?
I'll tell you what I think is the best way to do it.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to tell you how Oscar did it.
And I'm going to take notes for our next one-on-one, okay? So be very detailed in your response.
I think it is helpful when you're going to complain about stuff to, number one, you want to show a commitment to the company. When someone comes to you and they're invested, as a manager, you're like, oh, this person's invested and I want them to continue to be invested. And now I've got to solve this problem because otherwise Nina's going to be out if I don't solve her problem. And you want to make it clear that solving this problem makes everyone better. Two is, as much as possible, you want to talk about the problem from your own experience versus saying that you're representing someone else. One of the things that drives me the most crazy is when someone comes to my office and says, people are complaining about X. I'm like, well, which people are complaining about X? Or how do I know people are complaining about X? Always just speak for yourself.
Wait, okay, can I pause right there and ask? So if you're part of a team, you're hearing things, your colleagues are saying a thing, and then you go to boss and you go, this is how we're feeling.
Yeah.
That's like, no, don't speak in generalities.
For me, it's not. I mean, for me, it's like, you might say, like, I've talked to other people and I think they feel the same way, but I'm just going to talk about myself here.
Copy that.
And then you can have your other colleagues. They should come in and talk to me also. That's all. That's even better. If I hear the same thing from three different people, that's better than one person representing three people.
Yep. More believable, too.
Absolutely.
Because anyone can say anything.
Yeah. And then I think the last part is that if you have a solution, that's really helpful. Because a lot of times as a manager, you're managing a million different problems. you're maybe not on the ground floor. So in Oscar's case, someone comes who's a baggage handler complaining to the CEO. He has no idea about how to solve baggage handler problems. But if they come with a solution, it might not be the right solution, but it gives him a hint about where the solution might lie or who else he should bring into the discussion.
Yep.
So those are my three tips. What Oscar did was he just listened and he kept a list and he showed people his list and he set up a website where people could start airing their grievances.
Wow. That's bold.
Yeah, it was pretty bold. And he just made it clear that he wanted to hear this stuff. That was a big part of how he got people to complain, was he kept insisting he wanted to hear their problems. Hmm. You know, one thing I really wanted to ask Oscar about was the incident with Flight 3411. So for some background, four paying customers were selected to be involuntarily deplaned from United Express Flight 3411. So this was a partner airline, not United Airlines. It wasn't that they were overbooked. United needed to get four people to Louisville to be on another flight somewhere else.
They were employees.
They were employees.
That had to go to Louisville for another flight or something.
Exactly. They needed a crew.
They needed a crew.
Exactly. They needed a crew in Louisville, and they had to get them there. Dr. David Dao, 69, a Vietnamese-American, was injured when he was dragged from the flight by the Chicago Department of Aviation security officers.
Hmm.
He was like, I'm not getting off this plane. I've got to get to Louisville, too. And someone filmed, or maybe many people, filmed the incident. This doctor being dragged, basically, through the aisles. I vividly remember watching this video and just being horrified. And the video went viral. It was one of the first incidents I really remember of, and Oscar says the same thing, of a corporate mistake being seen and talked about by the entire world. People were furious. Let's listen to Oscar talk about it.
This was, so facts first. This was early on, this whole social media thing.
Right.
Even though it was 2017, which just seems like yesterday, we might have been the first viral global brand to be virally hit by something like this.
Yeah.
So the response that that we made, or people made on my behalf on Twitter, was, didn't think it was going to go really far. There was a word used in the initial phrasing by a staff member that people were worried about. So let's change that. So we used the term, and I approved the term, just to be fair, of reaccommodated versus overbooking, because overbooking is a verboten word in our world via regulatory issues. And again, if I had sat the learning and watched that video until I literally got sick to my stomach, along with my team, we would have never used that word. I would have never used that word. So first failing is understand the details and watch what's relevant is how people feel. Back mm-hmm. to leadership. Not about you, but I got caught up in the facts. The doctor was not an upstanding citizen, and he fought the Chicago police, and there was no real United employees engaged. It was United Express, which is a different airline. The pilots that were trying to get on were not, you know, part of the United team. I was defending our employees because we run into these issues all the time. And of course, that just fueled the fire even more. And the doctor said he was Chinese. So we've got between 400 and 800 million views. I get different numbers on Weibo in China. So I became globally infamous really quickly. The second lesson is it is never, never too late to do the right thing. The next day was spent trying to, oh my gosh, you know, this is a disaster, and calling the board and trying to figure out what we do. And then a decision was made that I had to go on live on TV on Good Morning America, of all things. And then I spent a few hours sort of being guided and coached. How do you effectively tell the story that, you know, it really wasn't United? It was, you know, all that thing we just discussed. And your sense is immediate. It's like, nobody's going to care. And I'm going to sound like every other, you know, CEO. And back to my upbringing and how I was raised, the middle of the night, I wake up and I fall to my knees. I get on my knees. Not an overly pious person, but you know, I look. It's like, gosh. And my grandmother came to my view, and you know, it made me think about her approach. She never complained. She helped others. She never pointed the finger. And it's like, that's who I became. And the thought of getting on national TV with tens of millions of viewers and beginning to sort of this spin thing, I kind of had a sense that I would have to talk about this for the rest of my life. So I went sort of rogue. I didn't know exactly what I was going to say, but when she confronted him with the obvious question, I said it was a horrific thing. And I let policies and procedures that we have in our industry get in the way of doing what's right for another human being. And for that, I am sorry, we're sorry. We're going to do lots of things about it. And the audible gasp in her ear from her producers, they're just loaded for bear, right? They can't wait to get another CEO. And then the louder gasp was from my team behind me. It was like, wait, he's not supposed to say that. In my mind, it was the right thing to do. And it was difficult, not because you take the blame and the buck stops here, because it's like, listen, no one's going to listen to anything else. We're going to put this to rest. And I've paid for it ever since, because a lot of my employees were very upset.
So you know what I really took from this, Dan, was the perception of a thing versus the facts, and understanding that perception is so important, because it didn't matter that it was a United Express airplane, and it didn't matter that it wasn't United employees who dragged this poor man down the aisle, it was the police. Everyone pointed to United as, you guys have horrible customer service and look what you did to this poor 69-year-old doctor. And Oscar having to go, and first he tried, I think, with the sort of facts-based approach of like, this isn't even really our, we're sorry, but it's not really our fault. And he said, the guy was not as peaceful as it had seemed that he was. He was actually a little bit belligerent, but like no one wanted to hear any of that. He had to go back and apologize entirely and just take a completely different approach.
Yeah, and I thought it was really interesting that his employees were mad at him for doing that. And I think that it's very clear he made, to me at least, that he made the right decision. Hmm. He had to say, this is on me. It happened on a plane that had United, whether it was a partner or not, that is a United flight. In the end, it's this sort of the buck stops here thing, and Oscar had to take ownership, I think, of it. And out of that came a conclusion that he had that he passed on to all of the employees, which is that we are going to start putting people over process.
Right.
And so it's a matter of really changing employee expectations when you say to them, we are going to back you, and you're a human, do the human thing.
When you and I were chatting about the interview, I said something like, that was such a great interview, and you were like, it was great, wasn't it? I'm curious what you thought was great about it. What makes a good interviewee?
I think anytime anyone is letting you in to their thoughts and their personal takes on things, and anytime they're talking about mistakes, usually that's a great interview. What makes a good interview for you, either for when you're listening to or when you're doing?
For me, conducting a good interview is when I feel like I like the feeling of like we're two adults that respect each other and friendly with each other and feeling like we're having a good time.
So what resonates with you about my conversation with Oscar Munoz? Let us know on LinkedIn using the hashtag ThisIsWorking. Or you can send us your voice. Make a voice memo on your phone and email it to us at thisisworking@linkedin.com. Either way, you might hear your contribution on an upcoming episode.
This Is Working is a LinkedIn editorial production. Our production team includes Sarah Storm, Candace Weiner, Stephen Valdivia, Asaf Gidron, and Lolia Briggs. Joe DiGiorgi mixes our show, Enrique Montalvo is our executive producer, Dave Pond is head of news production, our head of original programming is Courtney Koop. I'm Nina Melendez, senior producer.
And I'm Dan Roth, LinkedIn's editor-in-chief. Be well and stay curious.